of the few having too much and the many not having enough. That is not a new problem in the world, been with us for many, many ages. Excepting that in the kind of complex world in which we live, where peace and freedom and security are becoming indivisible, when some few get more than they need, and the great mass lack what they need, you get into serious trouble in our kind of complex world. Figures put out by the government on the shift in family savings indicates what's happening. These are danger signals. These are the kind of things that indicate the basic drift in the American economy. In 1945, the top 10% of America's income families had 46% of the net savings. In 1946, they had 63%. In 1947, they had 77%. And in 1948, they had 80%. The upper 10% had 80% of the total savings. And the bottom 30% were in debt. Now, what does that mean? That means that people who already have more than they need are getting an ever-increasing share. And people who lack the income to buy the simple necessities of life are getting a smaller share. This is not just a matter of economic justice, although that in itself is a compelling factor. This is more fundamental than the question of economic justice. This is a matter of economic survival, because we cannot survive in the kind of complex society with advanced technology that we have unless we achieve the mechanism by which to keep in balance production and consumption. So that this is more than just being against sin. This is a matter of how can you fight for survival in the world. The forces of blind selfishness, who want to hang on to more and more and deny the little fella his fair share, are driving us closer and closer to depression and disaster. And this thing can pile up fast. The 1929 depression didn't start 10 years ahead of that and pile up gradually. It happened quickly, because the kind of complex economic machine that we're dealing with, that's possible. Let's take the Chrysler Corporation. I've been trying for some weeks to get the Chrysler Corporation to agree to permit a committee of impartial citizens to sit at the bargaining table, because we have said all along that an argument between a union and a great corporation is not a private argument, because it affects the welfare of the total community. And we said, let's take a citizens' committee of educators and religious leaders, civic leaders, let them sit at the bargaining table as observers and see who's trying to settle this based upon facts. And the Chrysler Corporation has said no. They prefer to hide behind their full-page ads. We negotiated. They said we rushed into the strike. We negotiated for 6 months. More than 6 months. We started July the 6th, and we negotiated until January 25th. All that time, they didn't make us a proposal until we laid the strike notice on the table. Then they got a little bit of religion, but not enough. The strike continues because the Chrysler Corporation is unwilling to meet its responsibility to its workers on the same basis that other companies have met their responsibility. The tragedy of the Chrysler strike is more than just a matter of the Chrysler workers. It's more fundamental than that. The tragedy of the Chrysler strike lies in the fact that it reflects a complete lack of social responsibility on the part of a great corporation. It demonstrates a complete lack of an understanding of the kind of moral balance that we've got to get into our economic life if freedom is to be made secure in the world. Therein lies the tragedy. The Chrysler Corporation can afford to pay everything the workers are asking for and never miss it. They made in 1949 profits of $213 million before taxes, or 55.5% return on their investment. After they paid their taxes, all their taxes and all their operating costs, they still had $132 million left over, and based upon their investment. And that's the only way you can measure profits. Every time I use round profit figures, some industrialist says, "Now, wait a minute, Mr. Ruther, how much did we make on our investment?" Well, if you've got a few dollars in the bank, you get 2.5%. Chrysler did slightly better than that. They made on their investment in 1949, after they paid for everything, including taxes, $132 million, or 34.5% return on their investment. They could have paid every Chrysler worker the demand that we're asking, and they still would have made the return of 31% on their investment after taxes. They made more than $2,000 profit per worker, including the factory workers and the office workers. And you would think that a great corporation having made more than $2,000 profit per worker would, as a matter of simple common decency, have said to itself, "Well, these workers have contributed to our prosperity. Let's share a portion of these earnings with these workers." But the sad part is that the more some of these corporations make in profits, the hungrier they get. It's a kind of fatal disease. And the more they make, the less willing they are to share their profits with their workers. Now let's take Mr. Keller. He's the president of the Chrysler Corporation. We don't begrudge what the company pays Mr. Keller. What we object to is his begrudging the workers getting their share. Mr. Keller last year was paid by the Chrysler Corporation in salary and dividends $412,000 for 1949. When you translate that into a 40-hour week with 50 weeks in the year, that gives Mr. Keller $206 per hour. Now, when the board of directors in Chrysler had a meeting some years back, they got together and they said, "Now here's old K.T. Keller. He's been a loyal citizen, a loyal employee of the Chrysler Corporation, but he's getting along in years. One of these days he's going to be too old to work, but too young to die. And so we got to do something about his security in his old age." And one of the board of directors got up and said, "Well, now, of course, you can't expect Mr. Keller to put anything aside for a rainy day on a measly $206 an hour. So the Chrysler Corporation Board of Directors voted Mr. Keller a pension of $25,200 a year for every year that he lived after he retired. But when you turn around and say to a great corporation, "What about a worker who's worked all of his life for a company, who's given the company the best years of his life, faithful service? What about when he gets too old to work and too young to die? What about a pension for him?" Then these same executives stand up and say, "Why, you want to undermine his spirit of independence?" You see, the thing that's wrong We call it, the boys in the shop say, it's the old shell game. They say, if you've got too much, they give you some more. If you haven't got enough, they take it away from you. We say that that's the double standard. That you can't defend that double standard because it's morally wrong and it's economically stupid. Because obviously a man that makes $206 an hour doesn't need the consideration that a man who makes $1.65 or $1.70 an hour. Yet these are the kind of double standards. Now, a strange thing too, the basic fight in the Chrysler strike, and it was not until the 82nd day of the strike that the company agreed to the basic thing that we were fighting for in pension. Ford and Nash and the other companies had agreed to it without a strike, but not Chrysler. The thing that we were fighting about was the funding, the establishment of a pension trust fund into which the company paid money for the amortization of the cost of past service credits and the accumulation of future service credits. The company says no. They wouldn't agree to put a penny in the bank. We just had to depend upon their good faith. But the pension plan that they established for the executives was fully funded. They didn't depend upon the company's good faith. The money was in the bank to guarantee the payments. That's the kind of thing you're dealing with here. Now, on top of these fabulous salaries, on top of these more than generous pension plans, the Chrysler Corporation executives, in their interest not to neglect themselves, went even farther in 1949. They voted themselves a bonus of $9,600,000 on top of these other things. And this is the problem. Again, we don't begrudge the executives getting that bonus. That is not the problem. What we are saying is that this is merely intensifying the maldistribution of our economic system, and that in turn is threatening our economic stability, and that in turn is threatening the very security of freedom and peace and democracy in the world. Some of the Chrysler executives got as high as a bonus of $75,000. And I say that if you could look in to the household of one of these Chrysler executives, I'll bet you that the day he came home, the day he got a bonus, he didn't come dancing into the kitchen and throw his arm around his wife and say, "Honey, I just got a bonus, I'm going to buy you a new dress." I'll bet that she had all the dresses she needed out of the $206 an hour. I'll bet if you looked into those households of those executives who got the $75,000 bonus, that they didn't, following the receipt of that bonus, buy one more loaf of bread, or one more quart of milk, or one more pair of shoes, or one more suit of clothes, or another refrigerator or washing machine, or call the doctor one more time. Because obviously they had all those things they needed before they got the $75,000 bonus. But you put that money into the pay envelopes of 89,000 Chrysler workers, and it will buy milk and bread and shoes across the stores, counters of America. So that this is not, as I said before, just a matter of economic justice. This is a matter of economic necessity. How do you maintain a full employment, full production, full distribution economy? How do you create the economic basis for making freedom secure in the world? That's what this fight is about. Let me show you another double standard that we're fighting against. This is not one of our immediate demands, but you'll hear more about it as we go down the road. We're going to get in America one of these days what we call a guaranteed annual wage. We say the guaranteed annual wage is a matter of justice and a matter of necessity. But here again, you find the double standard. Mr. Keller gets his salary by the year. Mr. Keller and his family eat and live for the year. That's a very good arrangement. We like it just exactly that way. But the worker gets paid by the hour, but his family has to live by the year. And that's our basic problem. Now, when the good Lord made us, he made the children of the workers just as he makes the children of the corporation executives. And we thank him for that. And he made them all so that they might grow up in his image, strong in mind and body, grow rich in spiritual values, and become useful citizens. If he had intended that the children of the executives would eat for the year, he would have made them just as he made them. But if he had intended that the children of the workers would eat for the hour and live for the hour, I'm sure he would have put a little switch on their side so they could turn their stomach off when their father gets laid off. Now the problem is, how can you expect great numbers of people to buy and consume the things that our economy must depend upon when they are paid for the hour? We've got to get a guaranteed annual wage, because it's the only way that we can ever achieve a full employment economy on a continuous basis.